that Justice Ziegler has not participated and will not be involved in the case as we go forward. So the first thing you will see when it's time for you to begin is a green start sign. When you've talked enough to be to your 5-minute limit, you're going to see a yellow 5-minute sign, and then at the end, you'll have a red stop sign. I will try to help you keep track of that a little bit, because sometimes if you're reading from your notes, it's difficult to be looking up at the sign as well. So if you are both ready to proceed, I will now call our second case of the day, Applegate Badger Farms versus DOR. And I believe that Attorney Woody, you are the first to proceed. Are you ready to go?
I am. Good morning.
Please.
May it please the court. Ryan Woody on behalf of Applegate Badger Farm LLC. I'd like to begin this morning by first taking a minute to briefly describe the dilemma that is being faced by Applegate and many farmers around this state. I'll then move right into the main issue presented in this case regarding whether indirect environmental effects alone can trigger WEPA's threshold, before turning to the question of whether Applegate has in fact stated a bona fide WEPA claim. To begin, the 1990 Farm Bill created a number of governmental programs that allowed farmers to take marginal cropland out of active agricultural production and convert it back into natural wetlands. Farmers received compensation in exchange for granting the agency an easement. By and large, farmers thought this was a very good idea. These lands were generally not productive, and it allowed them to get the added benefits from the wetlands, such as preventing erosion and runoff and supporting the water table and wildlife. At that time, there was no disincentive to enroll in any particular program, whether state or federal, temporary or permanent. All the lands were classified and taxed on the same basis. That all changed when the Department of Revenue promulgated this rule. All of a sudden, some farmers were now stuck with huge property tax increases, all because they had enrolled in the wrong program or for the wrong duration. This gave neighboring farms a competitive advantage over those who had enrolled in the wrong programs. For those farmers stuck in permanent easements, they now faced a permanent property tax problem. As a result, many farmers began pasturing cattle in the wetlands and cropping the stream banks in order to obtain agricultural use value classification. Our contention here is that the department's rule is the only reason this practice is occurring, and that it affects the environment through increased flooding and erosion, reduced water quality, nutrient loading in the watersheds, and loss of wildlife habitat. These environmental concerns were brought to the department's attention both before and during the current rulemaking process. The department declined to investigate these allegations, resting on the premise that they were indirect effects of the rule and therefore did not trigger WEPA's obligations. The Court of Appeals acknowledged our concerns, but agreed with the department's finding that the alleged harm was an indirect effect, and as a result, did not trigger any obligations under WEPA. The Court of Appeals rationale rested on a line from this court's 1983 decision in Wisconsin Environmental Decade that secondary socioeconomic effects standing alone were insufficient to trigger WEPA's obligations. However, Environmental Decade 1983 was addressing a different WEPA question related to proximate causation, and this court's prior 1977 decision controls the questions in this case. To understand why Environmental Decade 1977 controls the issues in this case, it is important to look at the context of both cases. Environmental Decade 1977 presented a classic example of indirect effects, a utility rate change. Decade had alleged that the rate change would increase demand for electricity, thereby increasing pollution and depleting resources. The agency declined to consider those effects, stating that its rule was purely economic and those were just indirect effects. This court, in no uncertain terms, rejected the agency's position that because the effects were indirect, they would not trigger WEPA's threshold. By contrast, the court's decision in Environmental Decade 1983, again, turned on this question of whether certain indirect effects were proximately caused by any change in the environment. I think it's important that the court recognize the context in which Environmental Decade 1983 was decided. It followed closely on the heels of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Metropolitan Edison. Metropolitan Edison, of course, involved the decision to restart one of the nuclear reactors at Three Mile Island. Citizens there had asked that the agency consider their fear that there might be another accident. However, the agency limited its review to just the environmental impacts of the reopening, such as the release of low-level radiation and the discharge of warm water into the Susquehanna River. The Supreme Court ultimately agreed with the agency. It held that while the psychological harm might be reasonably foreseeable, it was not proximately caused by those environmental effects and therefore did not need to be analyzed under NEPA. Thus, Metropolitan Edison's causation analysis informed this court's decision in 1983, which of course involved a principal dispute between the city of Appleton and the town of Grand Chute over the location of a mall just outside of Appleton's city limits. Appleton had feared that the mall would effectively have a negative impact on its downtown business district. As a part of that mall project, DNR was required to approve air and water discharge permits. Appleton requested that DNR also consider the significant indirect socioeconomic effects that the mall's development would have on its downtown. DNR did consider the environmental effects as well as the indirect effects, but concluded that no EIS was necessary because the review found only minor environmental impacts. So following the lead of Metropolitan Edison, this court found that the possible decline of Appleton's business district was not causally related to the minor change in the physical environment found by the Department of Natural Resources. So while this court's 1983 decision could be read to say that indirect socioeconomic effects standing alone do not trigger WEPA's threshold, the decisive issue there was not the fact that the effects were indirect, but that they were not proximately caused by those minor environmental effects that was found by the that were found by the Department of Natural Resources.
Counsel, one of the questions that I have and I'd like to talk with you about, skipping ahead a little bit in the analysis, assume for a moment you're right about indirect effects and assume for the moment that a prima facie claim has been made, though we can talk more about those, obviously. I want to talk about this idea of an investigation, a sufficient investigation. You know, the statute is odd because it doesn't just apply to rulemaking. It applies to things like proposing legislation or potentially issuing orders or, you know, any other, you know, kind of significant action. But it would seem to me that in the rulemaking context, so long as you go through the rulemaking context, particularly if you're receiving the kind of evidence and having the kinds of conversations that are replete in the record in this case, that that itself might would seem to constitute the kind of investigation that would permit, you know, permit us to move to the next stage of whether a reasonable judgment was made. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Certainly, Justice Hagenorn. I think that that's a great question. And the Chapter 227 rulemaking process is an excellent place for an agency to essentially run parallel tracks here with its WEPA or with its initial investigation into the environmental effects. I think this court's decision in Environmental Decade 1981 provides a good example of that, where the Department of Industry, I think, had promulgating building codes, and it did basically a joint track. But that's definitely not what happened here. And before we get to the shortcomings of the record, I think one of the things I would like to point out that I think is significant to your question is that there were two key events that occurred here after the department closed its rulemaking record. So the department originally put out this rule that would have solved all of the environmental concerns that we have here. And that rule included all agricultural conservation easements. But after the record was closed, so they changed the rule from one that had that included all, everything to one that excluded tens of thousands of acres of wetlands. So the rule that it claims it collected and studied in the record is not the one that they ultimately promulgated. And maybe that's okay for purposes of Chapter 227 rulemaking, but I don't think that it's acceptable under WEPA. I think under WEPA, you need to at least consider the effects of the actual action that is being proposed. The second thing that wouldn't be included in the rulemaking record is the fact that they added, after the record closed, a permitting exception that allows for basically blanket compatible use permits for haying and grazing after the fact. And again, despite these changes, which we think are very significant, not a single rulemaking record was updated. No one additional analysis was performed. No further effects of these changes were studied at all. So I don't think that the agency can say that its 227 rulemaking record took a sufficient hard look at the concerns that were raised by the DNR, by the Wetlands Association, and by the UW professors.
So I hear that point, counsel. It's interesting here. So what we have in our 1977 case is a framework that was announced. The basic here, outline is, listen, you make a claim, agency needs to do some investigation, as we put it, with insufficient depth to permit a reasonably informed preliminary judgment before you get to that other piece. Now, that a record-making requirement is not actually in the statute. It is an extrapolation from the idea that if we're going to review this, we got to figure out some construct to do it. We need to make sure the agency's got something in place on which they made a judgment. Here, I understand that you think more should be in there, or maybe there'd be a separate investigation, but there's something in the statute that seems to require a dual track record. I don't understand why the rulemaking process itself, where you clearly had the kinds of conversations at issue here, and we would be overly stringent about a particular kind of record that looks a certain way when the statute doesn't require that. The statute requires only that you make the recommendation, and we said we just want to make sure that you've looked at it sufficient to make a preliminary judgment, not exhaustive, but sufficient to make a judgment. Why isn't what happened here sufficient for the agency to make a judgment?
Sure. I didn't mean to imply that there has to be two separate records or when I said dual track. I merely meant that the agency could tackle two birds shoot two birds with one stone here, I think. But they decided not to do that. They decided just to do the rulemaking and not focus on creating any preliminary factual investigation of those environmental concerns. It certainly would have been a good opportunity. And I think the record is very clear. They admit in the record that the rule, according to them, doesn't deal with wetland restoration or conservation. And to quote them, to the extent that this is an indirect effect of the rule change, the department is unable to measure the impact. So I think certainly we need a record, not because it says so in the statute, but it's a function of obviously of the court's standard of review. If there's going to be any meaningful review by a court, it can't be an implicit record. There must be something to this record requirement so that the court can actually do its job here and review it. And
Would you just say, counsel, that the kinds of questions that are raised here, the environmental concerns, were raised to the agency at various points through the process before the rule became final?
I think so.
If they were, then clearly information was given to an agency in the form of quite a voluminous record and submissions that I don't understand why in most situations rulemaking wouldn't, so long as you have gotten some, feedback on this question, why it wouldn't satisfy the requirements of this separate statute.
Again, I don't want to I think it is a perfect opportunity. I think this is a great time to do it. It saves resources. But I guess our problem here is that we did provide all this information, and all the department did was essentially collect it, collate it, and put it in a record. It can't point to a single document where it actually addressed any of these concerns. And in fact, its own representatives were deposed, and they gave testimony that said under oath that the only consideration that they gave to these concerns were whether it was economically related or fiscally related, and that they did not take any environmental concerns into consideration.
And Council, if I understand what you're saying correctly, then you are answering Justice Hagedorn's question with the concern that the requirements under WEPA were not what was the focus of what the rulemaking did, and that the rulemaking didn't make a record that a circuit court or another court could review and determine whether DOR reasonably decided no EIS was required, right?
That's correct. Again, I think it's a perfect opportunity for them to do both, and they could have, but there's nothing in this record to indicate that they did take that hard look. In fact, I think it's pretty clear. I really don't think that there's much of an argument that they ruled it out. And I think they did so based on their assumption that these indirect effects did not need to be studied because they were indirect. It's really the same record and the same responses that were given to this court in 1977 by the PSC. They said, look, we wouldn't know how to study this even if we wanted to. And our rule is economic. You know, our rate change, is economic. So there's no basis for us to look at indirect effects. And that's exactly what the Department of Revenue said to us here. And I think had it been clear that the 1977 case applies and that they do have to look at indirect effects to the extent, obviously, that they rise above a frivolous allegation, that they would have done their job. But I think they were premised on the wrong legal standard.
Well, don't they have to evaluate the argument that's presented here by Applegate under the statute 111.11, I think 2C and also D? I didn't see that in the record at all in regard to what went on in the Chapter 227 concerns.
Chief Justice, you're right. They didn't analyze it under that statute. And I think that because the effects were indirect and it was an economic rule that they felt that it couldn't be significant as a matter of law. But now I hear them arguing in this appeal that their conclusions were implicit and therefore still fully reviewable. And I think that they make that argument by stretching this court's decision language from Larson versus Munns. In that case, the department, I think it was an administration, had looked at a lease, and they had done a preliminary EA and EIS in accordance with WEPA, but did not expressly state on the record that it was not a type one decision. And so I think to stretch and say that the Department of Revenue's entire WEPA analysis can be implicit and still reviewable by a court not only stretches this court's case law, but really doesn't give much meaning to the procedural requirements within the WEPA statute.
Counsel, let's take a look at the statute and see how implicit fits in to the words of the statute. As I look at 1.11 2C, it says all agencies of the state shall. And then it goes on to say, in relevant part, include in every recommendation or report for legislation significantly affecting the quality of human environment, a detailed statement substantially following the guidelines issued by the feds under the federal corollary to the Wisconsin legislation. and it's cited as a public law there. And this is what they have to give. They shall give a detailed statement on one, the environmental impact of the proposed action, and it goes through any adverse, any positive effects. I won't read it all. And that also indicates in 2D that if you need help from any other agency, Department of Revenue, that this applies to all agencies, as the language in sub 2's preface clearly states, all agencies of the state shall. So how does implicit fit into 111? I don't see it. I know you're not making the argument, but upon what can an argument of implicit be based in the statutes?
Well, again, I don't think it's found in the statute. Obviously, there must be something that this court can look at. I don't know that it has to produce, you know, a 2,500 page, like the DNR did in the Bohm case, environmental assessment. But I think that we need to have the agency just acknowledge that, hey, we received these comments.
Well, counsel, what does a detailed statement mean to you?
Well, I think it means at least a report going over these items and saying we considered it and we made some finding that either yes, it applied, no, it didn't, and here's our math on that. Here's why we came to the conclusion. I don't know that it needs to be extraordinarily lengthy, but there needs to be something that this court can look at. And I will obviously point out that they argue that the CEQs that are referenced, those federal regulations, are only applicable to the actual formatting of that report. I just want to make sure that I think that this court was clear in Larson that that's not true, that this statute effectively included them all, incorporated them all by reference. And going back to the point that I was making about the indirect and direct dichotomy, I know that the new CEQs came out after our briefing was completed. I think that was September 14th of this year. And they've completely removed the distinction between direct and indirect and just essentially said any effects. And that's consistent with the text of this statute, which requires that any adverse environmental effects be disclosed. So, you know, I think that the question presented this court, going back to that question, should be able to be analyzed, answered just by the text of the statute. I want to just back up briefly while I still have some time to explain why we think that we have made a bona fide WEPA claim here. I think that the department really, for whatever reason, calls our premise counterintuitive and speculative. But our premise all along has been, I think, rather simple, that those excluded from the rule will ultimately end up pasturing in the wetlands and cropping the stream banks in order to receive use value classification. And then we've decided, you know, we've discussed how that causes environmental harm. And I think the record shows that causal link between those two. But if there's any doubt that this statute or this regulation has that cause and effect, I mean, I really think it comes down to common sense, in that if the department's rule increases your tax per acre from $1.62 to $25, as indicated in petitioner's appendix 115 and 116, I think this is a significant economic penalty. And if you have the ability to go back to $1.62 an acre by pasturing your cattle in the wetlands, you're probably going to do it. The Wisconsin Wetland Association's survey of farmers confirms kind of our fundamental premise on behavior, that 44% of farmers said that tax concerns influenced their land use decisions, and 48% admitted to pasturing cattle in the wetlands and on the stream banks in order to obtain use value classification. So I don't think that that's a counterintuitive premise. I think it's actually a rational economic decision that most people might make.
Council, In averment 207, we have a few averments in your amended complaint. And I note that this complaint is not set forth in the appendix. But anyway, we have it. In averment 207, you aver that the department ignored and or failed to consider evidence in its possession from the DNR that the exclusion and removal of wetlands and agricultural conservation easements from the cited tax provision definition of agricultural use causes farmers to destroy sensitive wetlands by placing cows within the wetlands to achieve use value assessment. That's what you're talking about, and I want to point to the averment that complements what you're talking about. Question I have in that averment, though, it says, consider evidence in its possession from the Department of Natural Resources that the exclusion and removal of wetlands is causing a problem. Where in the record does it show the evidence from the Department of Natural Resources? I see the wetlands survey. I see the Ducks Unlimited and the waterfowl hunters averments that scores of farmers are affected negatively. But what about this DNR thing that you refer to in 207?
Counsel, you may answer Justice Bradley's question.
Thank you. So, yeah, this has been a longstanding issue, and the DNR had lots of conversations between the year 2000, 2005, when a big tax committee was put together. I can tell you at least there's one citation from conversations that Richard Wedepole of the Department of Natural Resources had with the Department of Revenue. I think it's Petitioner's Appendix 128. I believe that's an email going back to 2005. But there's a lot of evidence in the record that the Department of Natural Resources was making this observation, saying, look, assessors, we're seeing this, assessors are seeing this, that they're pasturing cattle in the wetlands. And so this is not a new issue. I mean, there was a decade worth of study on this, and it just kind of got swept away when this rulemaking went into took over.
Okay, thank you very much. Are you ready to proceed now?
Yes.
Please do.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Anthony Russomano, and I represent the Department of Revenue, which is the defendant respondent in this case. There are a few things I would like to hit on that came up in the first part of the argument, but I'd like to, if I may, start with a bigger picture point to try to maybe clarify a few bigger issues I think might be coming in here. So we're talking about here is one subsection of a definition of agricultural use. There are other subsections that aren't in dispute here that include things like cropping and pasturing. Those aren't in dispute. Those are always part of agricultural use. And this rule is a product of a statute, which is also a product of the Constitution, where agricultural land is taxed differently than other land. So by the constitutional amendment, ag land is taxed differently. And then there's a statute that instructs the department to define agricultural land. And the statute says agricultural land shall be assessed according to the income it generates. So the fact that agricultural land is taxed differently is a product of the statutes, not this rule. And I think that's important to keep in mind because a lot of what we're talking about here about motivations, about people wanting to do things like graze or farm, that's a product of the statute and the Constitution. And when folks decide to farm land, they get a lower tax rate. They just do. It's not a product of this rule amendment. They get the lower tax rate because the statute 70.32 sub 2R says they do. So the whole point of the constitutional amendment, the whole point of that statute is to incentivize farming. That is not the Department of Revenue's choice. It is not what its rule is about. It is no choice but to cover farming by its rule. It has to do that. So that is not what this case is about, whether farming is good or bad for the environment, whether or not farming should get a tax break, and whether that tax break is incentivizing people to farm. The whole point of the statute is that it tends to incentivize farming. That's not the department's action that's in question here. So I think if that the court takes a look at that statute and thinks about it that way, that'll help clear up a lot of things we're talking about here about incentives and what this rule does and doesn't do. It's not controlling who, you know, farmland taxation, this subsection we're talking about today. So I wanted to throw that out there and make sure that the court understood that kind of basic structure. And I guess while I'm talking about basics, the statutes also separately define undeveloped land, which is how Applegate's land is taxed right now. And an undeveloped land is taxed at half its fair market value. This is also in 70.32 and it's sub 2, sub C, number 4. And that definition actually includes wetlands. So wetlands by default fall under undeveloped land. And what's happening here is the Department of Revenue, in the process of defining what is agricultural use, which must include cropping, which must include pasturing, also includes some programs and easements. It reaches out and grabs some more land to put it in this definition when that land retains a nexus to agriculture, only when that land retains a nexus to agriculture, because this is an agricultural use definition. It is being taxed as farmland, and that's it. It's not, the department has no discretion to include wetlands, period. It would be violating its statute. So I think it's helpful to step back and understand that before we talk about, you know, what would be nice environmentally, because the department isn't just given a free hand to go out and change the tax rate on wetlands. So if that's clear enough, I can move on then to some of the more specific things that came up during the first argument that I want to make sure folks understand. And one is, it goes to Justice Ann Walsh Bradley's question about 111.2c. And I just want to make sure our position is clear on that. We completely agree that revenue did not create a detailed statement, or an EIS, as some folks call it, implicitly or explicitly. It didn't create one. The issue here is whether it was required to. So the shall in 2C, you shall create a detailed statement if it's a major action significantly affecting the quality of the human environment. The question here is, as a matter of law, the department have to conclude this was a major action significantly affecting the quality of the human environment? If the answer is yes, then yes, you have to do a detailed statement. And of course, it has to be explicit. You can't do a detailed statement implicitly.
I think the question comes before that. I think the claim that's made here is that the department did not do a factual investigation about whether this rule would in fact be a significant effect. Would this rule impact the standards set out in 111? And 111 is not driven by direct or indirect. That's not the test that the statutes use. So I think that the question is, I think there's no dispute that DOR did not do a factual investigation of the effects of this rule on the human environment. They didn't. I think your brief agrees with that. I think that you rely more on the direct indirect, but my concern is with the statute, 1.11. What is required under 1.11, and was there a WEPA investigation done here? I don't think so. I think the question is before whether you were right in not doing an EIS. The question is, were you right in not doing an initial factual investigation? That's what bothers me.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I will like to clarify then on that position too. I think as Justice Hagedorn raised, the statute has no factual investigation requirement. The statute says if it's a major action significantly affecting the environment, if, then you do a detailed statement. That's all the statute talks about. So
right,
the requirement
that's
is,
right.
So what we're talking about, a factual investigation, is not in the statute. So the answer to your question, Your Honor, is the statute does not require it.
Okay, so you say, but don't we talk about 111 in other cases, and don't we require a factual investigation when we discuss what 111 requires?
Yeah, yes, Your Honor, and in the context of having a reviewable record. So
right.
as a practical matter, a court needs something to look at. So
right.
That's really not the practicality, not the statute. And as a practical matter, this court has something to look at. So I think this case, 1981 case, points that out. A rulemaking record, and I actually have it here. I'll read it if it's helpful. The rulemaking procedures seem to parallel consultation, notice, and hearing provision of WEPA. Persons or organizations with opinions as to the environmental effect of a rule can make their views known to the rulemaking body, and 227 procedure provides a framework for comprehensive consideration of environmental factors. So in this case, folks did and certainly could have and did say anything they wanted to do about the environmental factors. It was collected, it was summarized, and DOR did explain that the extent folks are concerned about wetlands.
DOR did not make a record of the environmental, of a factual environmental impact of the rule. They didn't make a record of that. If they did, I've missed it.
Your Honor, I think disrespectfully, I think we're conflating two different things. The analysis under WEPA is done if it's a major action. That's when you do the analysis. Before that, there's no requirement to do analysis.
You argue in your brief, there's no prima facie case made here. So there was no requirement to do an analysis.
Correct.
I understand that. But to me, you missed the question, which is how can you make that decision until you've done a factual investigation? Maybe if the record were different, I would agree that an EIS is not required. I might, but I don't have anything that I can review to let me know whether it is or not. I mean, there's no, the first step is DOR do its procedural obligations under the statute, right? And I interpret that as meaning it has to make a factual investigation of the environmental effects once there's been enough information provided that becomes a concern.
And Your Honor, and just I'll get again make sure my position is clear. The statute says nothing about that factual investigation preceding a detailed statement. And the fact that factual investigation comes up in the cases and in the context of having a reviewable record, which we believe this court has and 81 decision supports, I realize that's not Your Honor's position or understanding, but that is our understanding of the statute. And as Your Honor also pointed out, what we're talking about right now is part three of our brief. And we do have two preceding arguments that I don't want to totally lose track of in our as a discussion here about whether this is a bona fide challenge and also whether Applegate has standing. But before I leave part three, I just want to make sure that there's no confusion about our position there, that reviewable record, we believe, is before this court. A rulemaking proceeding allowed anyone with any environmental opinion they wanted to raise it. There's no statutory requirement of some kind of investigation. This step one is just, did the agency err by not investigating and doing a detailed statement? That is the question presented. And then we think the answer is certainly not, given the circumstances. And I guess if I may, then I'll pivot back to kind of the first two points we make in our briefing. And in fact, what the prior courts settled on and didn't actually reach this point three about records and all of that. And that is whether Applegate stated essentially a claim, whether they have a bona fide factual predicate. And I think the comments I started with today are meant to get at that to the extent they talk about they point to anything, they're talking about the effect of farming on the environment and whether they think getting a tax break incentivizes people to farm. And assuming that's true, that's a product of the Constitution and statutes, not this rule. And I think that if I can get that point, make that point clear, I'm happy to, but this rule does not affect whether farmland gets a tax break. It does by statute. This rule's amendment increased the amount of conservation land that gets a tax break. It included more conservation land in that bucket. And actually DOR reached out, or it reached out as far as it possibly could under its statutory authority. And put this in better context, what Applegate's asking for in this case is that its land, which is recreational land that is in a permanent conservation easement, it can never again be used for farming, has no permits to do farming. It's totally legally divorced from farming. It's saying that land should be taxed as farmland. That's what it wants. It wants its non-farmland to be taxed as farmland. And they're saying that revenue had to do an environmental study about not including their non-farmland in their farming rule. That basic premise is problematic. And so the fact that revenue went out and got a lot of conservation land in and it had some possible nexus to agriculture, it's doing the environment potentially a favor. It's giving people opportunities they might not have had, but it can't only go so far. So I just want, yes.
With regard to your issue on standing, your argument on standing and the facts presented, it seemed to me that you were unfolding for us a case that is fact specific. And I don't think we took this case in and of itself to determine whether this defendant, or rather this petitioner, had standing. And we took the case, of course, because of an issue set forth in the petition for review. And the petition for review issue dealt with the direct indirect dichotomy and how it applies here. And so why should we treat this as a fact specific case as you advance? I mean, I'd almost say, you know, that we should, we didn't take the case for it, and we shouldn't take a case just for resolving one individual's issues facts specifically.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know. I certainly don't want to step on the court's toes about how the court wishes to proceed. I think I can point out in our briefing at every stage of the case and in our response to the petition for review, we've raised every issue that we now advance here. So all of these issues are live before the court as far as procedure involved, and we think all of them are independent reasons to affirm, which is however the court arrives there, we think there are more than one way to get there.
Would you help me with this? Because I note in the Court of Appeals decision, it someplace towards the end says, I think it says the parties agree that this case has to go back to the circuit court because there are underlying issues that haven't been addressed. What underlying issues haven't been addressed? It wasn't clear to me by the Court of Appeals quick reference what it was referring to.
Sure, Your Honor. And what the court's referring to is not the claim the court is hearing today. What happened was the court, there was 9 claims and the court carved off 2, didn't address the other 7, and just addressed the 2. And because the party prevailed in one of the 2, it went up on appeal. But the issues before this court are done. They can be decided today. What would happen then if it would go back and the other 7 claims would be decided from the beginning, there'd be summary judgment and so on. So it's a separate set of claims divorced from what we're talking about today.
What would the remand be? I mean, there has to be a remand here for the very reason we were discussing, to the circuit court for the other reason. But if the court disagreed with your interpretation or the Court of Appeals interpretation of the 1983 case, which really rose and fell on the issue of direct versus indirect. It started out, I think, in the first paragraph. If not the first, it's the second paragraph. We conclude and they concede that it's indirect and end of case. And that's how the way they ended it too. So if we would disagree with the Court of Appeals analysis, where does the remand go? Does it go first to the Court of Appeals? Or does having decided the issue of direct versus indirect, or does the remand go to the circuit court? I mean, certainly. So do you have an answer to that?
Yeah, if I may answer it in a bit, in 2 parts. And one is I want to make sure we're clear on DOR's position and the Court of Appeals decision aren't one and the same. So the Court of Appeals, you're correct, Your Honor, said as if it were a bright line decision that indirect effects, game over. And it took that from the 83 decision. It did actually go on to discuss other things after it said that in the Court of Appeals decision. And what it actually went on to discuss was right, that where it said that there's what's being alleged here doesn't make sense, doesn't add up. It assumes people are violating easements, all that. But that initial statement that said game over, we don't adopt that position. We haven't in any of our merits briefing taken that position that direct and indirect effects are the question here. Indirect effects, as I think we say in our brief, can theoretically be significant. We don't disagree with that. That's not our argument.
Does your argument include that the Court of Appeals analysis of indirect effects is incorrect?
Yes, well, its statement is incorrect that indirect effects categorically could never trigger WIPA. There's nothing in the statute that says that.
And so, is your understanding of the Court of Appeals decision that it was such a categorical decision?
My understanding is that statement was categorical, but it went on to discuss the substance. That's one, a couple paragraphs, as Your Honor points out, but what it discusses after that, it's not applying a categorical rule anymore. It actually goes in and discusses, by the way, this case is not like the 77 environmental decade case. It's different. By the way, they're assuming that other actions have to take place here. There's a causal problem here. That's all in the Court of Appeals decision as you read further in. None of that would be necessary if they were just saying indirect effects, game over. That all of that discussion is almost like an alternative basis, although the court doesn't label it as such. It actually goes through and justifies its decision in light of the 1977 environmental decade case. So it essentially, for the sake of argument, ignores the 83 case and then analyzes the case under the 1977 case if the court reads on further in the Court of Appeals decision. And that part of the decision was right, but the categorical statement that indirect effects can never do it, that first statement wasn't, we don't think, justified.
And at the end, when they do their summary, what about that?
I would have to grab the opinion, Your Honor, but I guess my, to the extent that the court says it's a categorical ruling, that part of it's wrong, but sometimes actions speak louder than words, and to the extent it actually analyzes the substance of the claim, it was right. And to get to the question you actually asked me, Your Honor, no, it's not a remand to the Court of Appeals. This court, it's a legal question. This court just gives the right answer. What's the right analysis? That's what I think the result is in this court. And we think the right answer is, as we argued in our brief, in our lead argument, which does not turn on direct and indirect environmental effects.
Let me just go ahead, Ann. Let me know when you're done.
Okay, thank you. I just want to follow up that then who applies the facts to the correct legal standard, if indeed it is the correct legal standard? Does the Court of Appeals or does this court?
Any appellate court can take a set of facts and apply it to the law. It's a legal question. There aren't any facts to find here. There's no fact-finding question here. It's whether WIPA or whether Applegate has identified a bona fide factual predicate triggering WIPA, whether what it says makes sense. That's the legal standard in plain terms. And then you look at see what it alleged and really look at it. Is it bona fide? It's not just on its face. Can they string together a sentence? Is it bona fide? Does it make sense? Can you measure it?
Thank you.
Is it causal? Thank you.
Okay, I want to bring you back to 1.11 again to be sure that I understand where you are.
Yes.
Is it your position that DOR had a hearing to determine whether its rule, quote, significantly, end quote, affected the quality of human environment?
It held a rulemaking hearing. It did not hold a specific WIPA hearing.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your answer to my question.
It held a rulemaking hearing. So when you're promulgating a rule, a hearing is required. It did not hold a hearing specific to WIPA.
Okay, so, but 111 requires that all agencies determine whether their actions significantly are affecting the quality of human environment, right?
It requires that if it significantly affects the environment, you do a detailed statement.
Right, but you see, you and I are not communicating today. You always want to start it out with, if it significantly affects. Well, if it significantly affects, I think you and I agree that an EIS is required. My concern is, how did DOR determine whether it significantly affected the quality of the human environment? Was there fact-finding done to make that determination? That's what's bothering me.
Right, and there wasn't specific to WIPA, Your Honor, and I guess I'll just restate my position before that the statute says nothing about doing that. And I'll just point out in sub D, which I think Your Honor was just reading from, it says,
well,
it starts out saying
the statute, right?
Prior to making any detailed statement. So before you do a detailed statement, before you start writing it, you need to do those things. This case didn't involve a requirement or a detailed statement. And I'll also point out this case, this court's 1981 case holds, I believe, that the hearing under rulemaking is the functional equivalent of the hearing under WIPA. That is 104 with second 640.
But 1983 was not an environmental case. 1983 had socioeconomic concerns as the driving factor. It wasn't like the 1977 case that had environmental concerns, which to me is more like this case because it turns on alleged environmental concerns.
Your Honor, just to clarify the record, what I was just describing was the 1981 case, not the 83 case.
83, okay,
1981 case.
Mm-hmm.
That was not, that's not about the socioeconomic factors. It says that
okay.
rulemaking satisfies WEPA's procedural requirements. That whole, it's a holding at 649
okay.
of that case. And
to so I want to just give you an opportunity to address this bona fide claim and make your best case for that. Obviously, whether there's a record or reasonable judgment made isn't necessary if no bona fide claim has been made, as you pointed out. So make your best argument about how we evaluate whether a claim is bona fide or not and why this didn't satisfy that.
Sure, Your Honor. And I'll try to make it succinctly, but it may, I'll see what I can do. So if I had to reduce it to a sentence, what the cases, when you read them, talk about is, so bona fide, so is it real? Factual, is there something they can point to that's concrete that that is bona fide that you can start from and then make predictions from? Can you forecast from them in a way that, that has a causal connection with a, with a, with a physical impact on the environment? You have to eventually get to a causal connection to a physical impact. You don't have that, you don't have a claim, you also don't have standing under Fox and Milwaukee Brewers. So that's the basic test. Is there a bona fide? Can you point to something concrete and point to the other things you need to point to if it's not direct, right? That point to a concrete environmental impact from the action. Where is this action affecting the environment? Usually this is easy. If you look at the cases, almost always, the 1977 case I'll talk about in a second, but in the last, you know, the 43 years since then, almost always what we're talking about is a building project, a landfill, a mall, a prison. You're building something. That's easy. Okay, there's a hole, you're moving a river. That's the impact and you measure it. We're talking about something is much more abstract in this case. It's much harder to make your showing. That's why it's so, right? We harp on that first point because this is not a normal WEPA case.
I want to let you finish, counsel, but just to make sure I'm understanding your point that you made there. Your argument is if it's not predictive, and it seems your DOR did make a decision that this wasn't going to be, we can't determine what those effects would be. That functionally, that's the equivalent of DOR saying there's no bona fide claim here because it's not predictive. You're saying if it's not predictive, we can't measure it. It's not a bona fide claim.
I think that's right, Your Honor. And when I said earlier they didn't say that under WEPA, comma, this is not predictive. They said this is not predictive. So I think saying you have to have that clause saying under WEPA, comma, is really form over substance. But they did say we have no way of measuring that. And that's right. And the reason they couldn't measure it is not because they said it's indirect. We don't have to measure it. The reason they couldn't measure it because it's not measurable. What we're talking about here is, okay, just to go back to my, not to harp on it, but no matter what, you get a tax break for farming. Not about, that's not what this rule's about. What this rule's about is criteria that allow easements to also get that tax treatment as agricultural. Now, how do you get from that saying you can, some easements can get that tax treatment if they hold a bit of a sliver with agricultural use? How do you get to that to concrete environmental harm, significant environmental harm in the area where Applegate resides? And we have not seen any explanation how you get from that point A to the point whatever that is at the end. This rule does not change Applegate's tax rate. Applegate's always been taxed the same way. Does not change its easement. It's still in its easement. And the same goes for its neighbors. If they're in a permanent easement, they're still in a permanent easement. Where is the concrete environmental harm here? And I do want to briefly touch on the 77 case. The Court of Appeals, I think, succinctly explained why it was distinct, and I think they're right. That case talked about elasticity and demands for power. So we're talking about direct regulation of a power plant. That's a classic WEPA situation. And they're talking about rates. And there's such a thing as elasticity, which I'm no expert in, but you have sort of a curve, right? And you have certain constants, and then you can maybe predict the curve based on price about demand. That's a forecast you can measure. You can measure that in a sort of a document, right? There's nothing remotely like that here. There are no constants here. There's no elasticity you can measure on a line because you always get a tax break for farming. Here, we're just letting in more easement programs if people want to sign up for them. But we've never heard from Applegate is the remotest explanation of how you measure that in a 1977 elasticity sort of way. People can do whatever they want with their land.
I don't want to interrupt you. Are you finished?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
You're talking about the 1977 case. And of course, what we've been struggling with is the very thing that the 1977 case also addressed, rather. And that is the test as to whether an environmental impact statement should be conducted. And the test is one of, they say, reasonableness and also of good faith. And this is where the discussion that was previously taken place in this oral argument comes in part from. The test is, first, has the agency developed a reviewable record reflecting a preliminary factual investigation covering the relevant areas of environmental concern in sufficient depth to permit a reasonably informed preliminary judgment of the environmental consequences of the action? So there's a preliminary factual investigation in the 1977 case. This test is cited in several cases. It may not be in the statute, but the test has been formulated, and that's where you get the preliminary factual investigation sufficient in depth to permit a preliminary judgment regarding the consequences of the environmental impact. Is that not the first part of the test to determine whether an EIS should be conducted?
That is what the cases say, Your Honor. And may I address how I believe we've satisfied that?
Yes, sure.
Thank you. So I think you pointed to, also discuss good faith and a preliminary factual investigation. And I'll just say it one more time. I won't say it again. This court's 81 opinion points out that a rulemaking record gets you there under WEPA. And I think this rulemaking record demonstrates why that is. If the court were feeling masochistic and wanted to look through the whole record, there is many examples of Department of Revenue reaching out to all kinds of organizations and agencies, environmental groups, landholders like Applegate, the Wetlands Association, over and over again at every stage of this rulemaking, the beginning, at the middle, at the end, after the modification. They asked for more comments from the Wetlands Association and landowners. This was, they bent over backwards to get people's views. This was, they didn't put the stamp label on it, but it's very, very difficult to look at what they did here and say it was not in good faith. They were bending over backwards to get people's views at every stage. So I just want to make sure that's clear. They worked very hard on this rule over years, and they really, really, really wanted to get it right. And they tried very hard to. I don't think this is a bad faith situation. I think what you see in the record is more than sufficient to satisfy the reviewable record preliminary factual investigation requirement. The proof is in the record, not what it's labeled as. This would be my final statement on that.
Okay, I'm glad you didn't say the proof is in the pudding. this 1977 case then also indicates that the burden is on the petitioner to allege facts constituting a bona fide challenge to the agency's obligations, not to prove those facts. Is that a correct statement of the law?
Counsel, you may answer Justice Bradley's question.
Justice Bradley, I think that's right. They have to allege bona fide factual predicates. And I would just point out that it requires a bona fide allegation. It can't just be a statement. It needs to be a statement that holds up to scrutiny. And that's, I think, why these fail.
Thank you very much. Are you prepared for a rebuttal?
I am. Thank you. I'd like to just quickly touch on the standing point that came up, just because what the department here is doing is completely conflating our injury on the other claims that we've asserted with the WEPA injury. And that's what's causing their confusion, I guess. So they claim that our WEPA injury is that our land was misclassified, but that's not our WEPA injury. As we've explained in the reply briefs, pages, I think, 7 and 8, our injury here is to both our property and our aesthetic interests. So Applegate is a very large landowner. It has a farming operation, and it has these wetlands that we're talking about. So the farming operation, as explained in our standing affidavit, is harmed when the it's harmed when the water quality and the water table are polluted. And we've alleged that the pollution and the nutrient loading it stems from the destruction of these wetlands. So there is a tie to the physical land and injury there. And likewise, we have these wetlands that are basically constitute the Avon Bottoms in Rock County. They surround the Sugar River. And our principal essentially testified in the record, I think it's record 39, pages 7 to 16, that land suffers from upstream runoff and reductions in water quality. And so...
I appreciate that. I know we're running low on time. I wanted to just hear, if I could, your response to your opposing counsel's argument that a non-measurable bona fide, non-measurable claim, a claim that's sort of downstream that can't be measured with any kind of beyond speculation, that is not a bona fide claim unless it can be measured. I want to hear your response to that.
Well, that, of course, that was the argument in 1977, that they couldn't measure what that increase in demand might lead to if it led to anything at all from that rate change. And I think the court settled that, at least squarely addressed that speculation comment, and that speculation is implicit in WEPA, and it requires a degree of forecasting. So I don't see that this is necessarily a very difficult question to ask of the agency. If investigating harm to wetlands and corresponding effect on water quality is too complex for the agency, what does that make for more complex investigations like the rate making in 77, or heaven forbid, a controversial subject like climate change? If the court's going to say that we can't figure out whether this wetland degradation is happening and what effect that might have on water quality, I can't anticipate many, many situations that agencies in the future are going to say, well, there's just too much for us here to study.
I'm sorry, I didn't want to interrupt. Were you done?
I was also just going to make a point that we have facts in the record. The wetlands tax study provides an example, that a 5-county study that provides facts that 50% of these owners were getting use value. It's not because the assessors are just totally misclassifying the land. It's because those owners are pasturing and cattling those sensitive wetlands. Sorry, Justice Dallin.
No, thank you. Counsel, can you address Attorney Rossomano's argument that the rulemaking hearing sufficed in terms of gathering evidence and that an additional type of review by DOR would not be necessary?
Again, I think it could have had it followed the 1981 case that they're citing, but they didn't notice this rulemaking. None of the public certainly didn't know that, hey, now this is also a forum for me to address my environmental concerns. They had no idea. The department didn't say, we're concerned with the environment with this rule. We also want to gather comments for that. I think had they done that, then they have a better argument that was a sufficient record. But again,
so them reaching out to the groups that they did, as Attorney Rossomano described, is not sufficient.
Right. I think that's the first start. But if they're going to rest on, hey, we reached out to groups and we collected their comments, that's like the first step. You can't just collect. I think that's what the D.C. Circuit said in Calvert Cliffs in 1971. You can't just collect and collate comments. You've got to study and investigate them once you receive them. You can't just say, all right, well, here I've got the comments. Here's my record. I think for the record requirement to have any meaning, there has to be at least some basic analysis there. I see my time is up.
Yes, thank you. Thank you both very much for a tremendously interesting case. You both did a great job, just a super job. And I certainly picked on you a lot in your comments, but I think it's very helpful to the court. The briefs were well done and the issues are just terrifically interesting. And I think we're going to probably see more and more things along this line as time progresses. So thank you for bringing it to the court for our review and attention, and we will give it careful attention. We are now going to adjourn, and the court will meet again in closed conference at 1:30. Thank you. We are adjourned.